Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Andrew, welcome to Weird Thing.
A reversal of fortune, sir.
Brian Brushwood.
Hey, man. I'm the one who pressed play right as you were drinking your soda.
And Justin Robert Young.
Hey, I'm Justin Robert Young.
Wow, man, that was original.
Yeah, I'm really the world's funny man.
I mean, to his credit, he is the only guy with that as his tagline. You know, very few people whose names aren't Justin Robert Young come in and say, "Hey, I'm Justin Robert Young."
True that. So, I noticed like on the Facebook some news, Justin, in your life, some like big stuff going on.
Maybe not this week, but like in general, in the last month, has anything huge happened?
Like, finally, yes.
You visited Seattle. How was that?
Yeah, I'm getting engaged. Yeah.
Oh, wait. So wait,
not engaged. I'm getting married.
Okay.
We're in the process of marriage.
Well, before the show, giddily, as if he had an epiphany on the toilet, Andrew says,
"It
Brian,
was in my car driving back from eating."
Brian, you realize Justin's getting married, which means he's going to care a whole lot about his partner. And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "He's going to have like these feelings, and it's tough." And he's like, "Yeah." And then Andrew says,
"I get to exploit those for the show."
now there's more brain cells to twist with agonizing scenarios.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's going to be curious to see how fundamentally different Brian and I are as people when it comes to deciding, whether or not we will save the lives or spare the horrors of our significant other. I think this is going to be very telling about me. We have a baseline of a good, caring husband and father, and then we'll see how much of a scoundrel.
Who knows the difference between engagement and a proposal and getting married?
Yeah, well, and also, yeah, I think we're gonna find out very quickly that Brian's a better human than I am.
So let's start with a little thought experiment, and there's kind of an adorable time travel movie. I'll let you figure out the title as I rip it off. Sort of part of the premise.
Is it Time Bandits? Please say it's Time Bandits.
God, I love Time Bandits.
It's the best. In fact, that's my pick. We're skipping straight to picks. My pick is Time Bandits.
Time Bandits Forever. Oh my God, that movie's amazing. Actually, it's about time. But anyhow, here's the plan. Here's the thing. Justin, I want you to imagine that you're walking through your apartment one day and you open up a door. You notice if you open up this door at like 12:01 p.m., you step through it. And imagine for a moment, back in maybe your junior year of college, you had like a crazy hot, crazy girlfriend.
All right.
Like crazy in the bed, crazy sex, whatever.
Sure.
Right? Full on.
Yeah.
You walk through this door in your apartment. That's 12:01 p.m. here. And next thing you know, you walk back into your dorm or whatever, and there she is. It's back in time.
So hold on. Like she left or?
No. It is as if we never left.
He travels back in time, back to one day, you know, back to one awesome day.
Oh, so you're saying like
it's not like there's an artifact and we have to charge up the crystals. It's just literally I'm in my kitchen for 1 second. I walk through the door, except this is not the door of my apartment in Oakland. It's into the Lawrence and Hall and Syracuse University. And it is 2002.
I assume like, can he feel his face and see whether or not he probably did have the same beard back then, but like is his body of him as a junior, or is he suddenly
it's
a 30,
it's Mr. Junior, but
man?
Now he's got control of himself in that point in time.
And does he remember the future? Does he remember?
Oh yeah. He's Justin now. And now he's like, he's back there,
man.
And so here's the thing is like you find out you can try to change stuff really, but you're in some sort of bubble where it's really, you really can't change much, but you can go back and kind of go back to that day.
So you can't stay there and live your life out.
Nah, because it's like, you know, end of the day, you're back in your body.
Okay.
So again, that would be the first question is just exactly how this ride works, right? And so trying to find out where, you know, at what point do I go back? And then you can start to make the moral questions of what is appropriate for me to do in this back in time form.
We wrap up this podcast. You're like, well, that's a stupid story, Andrew. Thanks. I got to go. You get up, you walk through a doorway, and next thing you know, you're back there. You're back in that day.
So, all right. But at some point I have to come back to the present to face and understand what I did in the past.
When you go to sleep, you wake up in the present.
Okay.
Right as walking through that door.
Okay. That's the key. That's the key. Because if I wake up and I'm back in the present, then all I am guided by is what I feel guilty doing in the past. Like, let's say theoretically, if we are looking at, you know, especially in the context of my fiance, soon to be my wife, do I feel guilty for through this wormhole banging my crazy ex-girlfriend, although then my present girlfriend, like basically living out the life that I had already lived and playing the part of as I go back in time. I'm the only one in that scenario that knows there's a moral conflict there or will ever know there's a moral conflict there unless for some reason the past starts to bleed back into the future when I wake up. Right?
And I guess also in that moment, you know, you said that when you fall asleep, you wake up back home. But in the moment, assuming there's only one trip, unless this is a multiple trip door or something, in the moment, I assume that you don't know that you're ever going back. Maybe you just walk through the door and you're like, oh, so I guess I'm suddenly a junior again. And the last, 12 years of my life was a fever dream.
Well, I mean, I guess that's my thought is that I would initially just do everything that I would want to do that would create no moral conflict for me back that I did when I was a junior in college. Like I would, you know, hang out with friends that I hadn't seen in a while that have maybe through their life and business and family and having kids have, become different people as we all do. We all evolve. I would hang out with them and have those same experiences again. I would, do all the things that I fondly remember of that point in my life that if my fiance / future wife was watching me do that, would just probably go like, oh, you, yeah, that's fun. You know, look at that. And then, I don't know, I feel like I would want to get the lay of the land before I started like, you know, banging my crazy hot then girlfriend.
But I guess, I mean, isn't this in some ways a very real thing that happens to us when we have dreams of our youth? Because I noticed that that I am bummed out by my dreams now because there'll be scenarios where someone wants to have sex with me or whatever, and I'll say no.
Somewhere, sometime.
I'll say no. And then I'll wake up and be all like, damn it.
It's the only place I'm allowed to do it.
I know, well, right?
This is where, as all paths and weird things, it's never a straight path. And so Justin's established that morally he would not engage in, be like, hey, listen, because for him, you know, his morality is something he carries with him. It's not an ocean he swims through.
Yeah.
So use that analogy as you wish.
But man, get that tattooed across your chest.
So Brian's jumped ahead to here. So what if you could go back, but it was a day that already happened? It was a day that already happened. You walked through that door, it was a day that happened. It was like a crazy snow day, crazy wild sex with this girl, whatever kind of thing. It was like one of those best days ever. You couldn't change anything, but it just was, you got to relive it.
So, but I'm on rails. Like, this is Pirates of the Caribbean. I'm just rolling through this day, and so I'm just a spectator in my head, and I'm acting it out, but it is the same reaction.
Yes.
That's just history, bro. Like, you know, you want to go back into the history textbooks and start yelling at everybody for doing things that might be different in the current context? You know, if we want to go back, we can get on all the founding fathers about owning slaves, okay? At some point, you just got to understand that it was a different time, a different place. We were all different people.
This, by the way, is, I believe, the plot of Kurt Vonnegut's Timequake, where did either of you guys happen to read that? the idea is at a random time in the early 1990s or whatever, suddenly every single person in the entire world snapped back 10 years in the past in their own body, but unable to change any of their own actions. They sat there as trapped prisoners, feeling every sensation, watching every bad decision get made. They had to re-experience every breakup and all that stuff. And one of the curious side effects is that in their own head, they just tuned out. They're just like, this is the fever dream of my life, and I'm not really a participant. I just have to watch it again, this agonizing, you know, that murder I committed, that hit and run, that breakup, or, you know, for various people. And then at the moment that time catches back up, nobody knows what to do. Everyone who is driving a car, because they're still tuned out, they've been tuned out for 10 years. They just stay tuned out and then plow into a wall. And the lead character, Kilgore Trout, walks around, and he's the one that has the epiphany of how to phrase it to everyone, where he just goes around to all these zombified faces and he says, "You've been sick, but now you're well." And it becomes this mantra. It was a fascinating and terrifying thought experiment.
Dude, you want to? All right. Now it's getting weird. Because, like, one of my college girlfriends was obsessed with Kurt Vonnegut, was the one that got me into Kurt Vonnegut. And I believe it's Timequake that references her hometown, which is why she loved that book.
That's amazing.
Dun, dun, dun.
And she's here. Pull back the curtain.
So we've said, okay, listen, if it happened, it happened. But for you to be like, what time is it? Let me hop through that door. Is that okay?
Oh, would you do
so
it?
Now how many times do I want to go back and relive that day? And does it begin to erode my moral fiber if I'm doing it every 2 hours?
Because the first time it was an accident. How were you to know what was behind that door? But now you've got a magic door to the past, and you can go through there as much as you want.
And really, how different is that than, let's say, other methods of escapist entertainment? You know, like pornography.
Well, and I was thinking specifically of, you know, there are couples where they're having marital difficulties and one partner or the other will escape into, you know, Facebook, where they can relive all of their glory days from before the marriage, which is a minor version of that, this same dilemma, right? It's like, you know, if you're married to this person and you're supposed to be shaping a life together, you know, does it really make sense for you to retreat and spend hours at a time, you know, reliving memories that were before this person?
Or with other websites like YouTube, where they can just continue to create a fan base of younger people and eventually amass over 1 million followers.
Man, I'd love to be in that position. Let me tell you.
We'll save that for the next topic. All right. But now, so we've established, you haven't given us an answer, Justin.
If I am just reliving it, and it is just a heightened version of me remembering those moments fondly, I get, all right, so here's my question is, do I relive it in real time, or am I reliving it like in a, like, do I blink out for 5 minutes and wake up, or do, like, am I out catatonically for 24
like
hours?
You have to take the day off and say, like, peace out. I'm spending Thursday back in 2002.
It's compressed. You're out for a few minutes or something, you know.
Then really, how different is it than remembering? I mean, like you, we already make these decisions. You know, if you choose to kind of live in your own past, then that is just the slippery slope to what we're talking about. And I feel like for me, I kind of find living in the past to be kind of the enemy of the future and the almost like a tap out that you are not happy now. And I force myself to rethink of, like, well, how can I make myself happier now? So I don't feel like I would do it all that often. However, I don't think that I would find it morally reprehensible that I would go through these visceral, like, you know, intense, no holds barred sex sessions, you know, from 2002.
All right. So I have a question here. At what point do you tell your fiance that you go, and how often you go? Do you tell her, like, the very first?
It would be, I feel like it would have to be an explanation for a change in behavior. Like if there was an observed change in behavior or there was a distance in our relationship that was created by it, if I could not have it just be a part of my normal personality, then I think I would be forced to my moral code would dictate that I would have to have a conversation about it. However, if everything is just hunky-dory and maybe even these releases make me a better, more attentive husband or fiance, then I feel like, you know, anything goes, baby, like Club Obi-Wan.
Man, that's crazy, because I'm going to assume that you go through this door and it's got rules like I can never remember the numbers, but the Stephen King book where there's like a doorway that goes to 1964 and he wants to prevent the Kennedy assassination. Did you guys read that? Basically every time you go through, time resets itself. So no matter how bad you screw things up in the past, you go to the present and you're like, oh, the whole world's at war now. And then you go back through the door and everything is reset to its original timeline. Like, if it's a penalty-free little area, how soon until you sort of follow the dark descent of Groundhog Day and start, like, I'm going to get in a bar fight. Like, you know, you're just mad. You're like, I want to hit something.
Oh, but no, in this scenario, you're on rails. Like, you are just...
Okay, all right, you're just experiencing it. All right, but it's just that one day over and over.
So, nothing is purely hypothetical here.
What?
Scientists have increasingly been able to locate and isolate where memories are in the brain. A couple years ago, MIT scientists actually created a breed of mice with optogenetic neurons. These were neurons that could actually be triggered by using light. Light would hit it, they would fire, and able to find specific locations in the brain. And what they would do is they would create like a frightening experience for a mouse, see where it took place, and later on go trigger that neuron again, and the mouse would relive that experience, which is showing us more and more how memories are localized. And there have been a lot of stories, accounts of people undergoing brain surgery. Scientists presses some part of the brain. Next thing you know, they remember eating oranges when they're 6 years old and being able to trigger very specific parts. And now we have magnetic stimulation, which is becoming more precise. We may very well live in a period, and may see a period rather, where you're going to be able to do this. We put on a helmet or do something like this and say, take me back to this period in time, because we find out there's a lot more stored up there than we realize. It's just like, you know, it's the indexing is the question. But computers, as they accelerate, you might be able to go back to all of those points in your life.
So, man.
Now, if I had to go to a place, and I think that's where really that the morality for me becomes a thing, because like if I have to take the time out of my day to go to a place to relive this one day, and I'm continuing to relive this one happy day I had with an ex-girlfriend, then yeah, at some point you're gonna have to have that uncomfortable conversation. Like,
so imagine what this is like. You know, you put on this helmet. Maybe you're using it to let's watch the first episode of Game of Thrones together. Let's relive that first experience.
Together, we can all remember it at once in this visceral moment. And then, like, even though we're having our own experiences, when we come back, we're all together and we can.
Yeah, I mean, it's a technology we're using for other stuff. You know, we can relive our own. We could maybe experience. We could like, hey, let's go to Woodstock, see what that was like. You know, man, it smells funny. So it could be these things. It could be a device we use for a lot of things. But like the internet, you know, one of the applications is.
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you what's weird for me, and this is a real thing, and this is the first thing that pops in my mind. I'm assuming that in this future version of the same technology, that at this point we have the ability to accurately record the states of enough neurons to preserve the true memory, because you've read the studies that say that the more every time you remember a memory, you alter tiny details, you sort of rewrite.
Oh, for
over
sure,
it, right?
For sure. But what might be interesting is that we might again, it's how the indexing works too. The real visceral experiences, whatever recorded, might still be there, and it might be layers of stuff on top of it. We don't know, but yeah, we absolutely overwrite confabulation, all this. But I'm gonna take you down out of the corner here.
That's fascinating, though, that it's your brain's middleman that's screwing up the details. Like somewhere that memory lives pristine, and it is the fetching of it for you Well, that is where the queering up.
Can I tell you, like personally, there's entire swatches of my life that I intentionally just don't look back on because they're so precious to me that I don't want to corrupt them by remembering them. And
that's the weirdest thing I ever heard anybody say.
No, this is true because I know at some point I'm going to run across a Facebook post of somebody who I haven't spoken to in 15 years, and a flood of memories will come pouring in, and they will be true memories, and that will be the last time I ever get to experience them uncorrupted.
That is fascinating point of view, Brian.
It's weird and dumb, and also it's like there's.
I'm not saying it's dumb. I have to think about this, Brian.
I mean, it's like
I don't think I fully digested that. So you don't want to remember things because you are afraid that once they are remembered in that one big visceral moment, you'll never have that visceral moment again.
I have nostalgia bombs all over this place. I have trunks filled with correspondence from elementary school up through high school. I have breakup letters. I have all of this stuff. And I don't look at them because they are wrapped presents of my past. And when this is a door that I get to open, and I know that the moment I read it, I will have a flood of memories. And the moment I have that flood, it will be the last time I get the true version of my current memory state of those experiences. Every time it happens from then on, it is colored by the last remembering and the current state I'm in. And they're all wrong and lies.
Once you step foot in the Ministry of Magic, you can never go back again.
I mean, that's just it, right? And so I want to keep them wrapped presents. I mean, let me open those when I'm 68, you know? Let me open those when people are gone and I want to relive it or whatever. It's a... meanwhile, there's so much life to be lived and so much money to be made by shaping your new and I say money. It's like, you know, that's my go-to phrase is that don't make no money. But it's like, you know, there's no money in the past, but there is this painfully sweet nostalgia. And again, you only get to open it once. That's the thing.
What if that loses potency over time, that for whatever reason, that there are certain connections that you have to your teenage self that are more alive when you are in your late 30s than when you are in your late 60s and you are.
Ooh, this is good. This is the question of which is it better to do, to keep the memory alive by turning it into sort of a robot version of itself that's been molded over time and becomes a really great story that didn't actually happen in that order? Or is it better to preserve it? Honestly, that's a very interesting idea. I
want to throw an ethical curve here.
Okay.
And I want to revisit this idea, Brian, cause I want to do a little more research into, you know, because the thing we're both familiar with is how people will reform stuff
and malleable
magic.
Memory,
you see this all the time. People don't recall 30 seconds later what happened, and they construct a thing that did not happen. So you have this ability, put this thing on your head, and you can revisit. You can go back to like, oh yeah, that crazy time, the time we all went to SpaceX. You know, all this sort of time, right? Let me go back and visit. Oh yeah, that really crazy college girlfriend, right? So that we're all okay with that, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Let me go back and visit that really, really hot high school girlfriend.
Hot kitty porn because it's you.
Wow. That first kiss, that first sexual experience, because an awful lot of us have sexual experiences before the state-sponsored number 18 years of age. Wow.
Well, luckily, I don't really have many that I would like to remember pre-18. they were certainly not things that I would be very excited to roll back through. But I understand the ethical and moral conundrum there. I guess really there is just the question of if it's in your own memory, it's already a part of you.
So think about this, right? I guess that's one thing. Like, yes, it's 100% legal for you to do it. However, we're talking about this. This is technology assisted, which means programs need to be written and artificially intelligent systems need to reconstruct and preserve these memories. When somebody types in, access this memory of when I was 12 and did my first strip poker game with Susie. At that point, is that the same as saying, show me a picture of a naked 12-year-old?
And even more so, if, as Andrew said, you could meet some, you know...
Don't drag my name into this.
Well, just you introduced the idea that we could go revisit Woodstock. Let's say you meet some dude at Burning Man who is at Woodstock, and meanwhile there's a tent where people are teaching you how to, you know, tie the devil's knot and making dark and stormies because it's Burning Man. And then you get handed a plastic lightsaber and a helmet gets on your head. And now you're able to share someone's memories. And this dude is remembering Woodstock. Let's say the next person is remembering the first time that he had sex at 14.
Right.
Now it is not your memory. You are watching somebody else's memory and it's the guy. So the girl who is involved in it, let's assume in our heteronormative culture that it is a guy and a girl, that they have no consent over a pornographic act that they did underage being broadcast into your mind.
Man, this is a whole future where I could see like a dark net of peer-to-peer memory trading, an illegal memory trade. Can you imagine that? Or it's like, you know, there'd be some like a Reddit of memories where they're, you know, like, oh, we downloaded this mass murderer's memories. Wait, you haven't lived until you've experienced, I don't even want to graphically describe whatever it is. But wow, that's a fascinating idea. And then what?
Ted Bundy was a murderer.
Well, and then you get into the weird thing of like, what about the trade of artificial memories? What if somebody starts selling manufactured, like, don't worry, nobody actually did this, but here's a memory we wrote as if they did, and you can experience it.
Well, I mean, certainly it would create a genre of fiction, no doubt, you know, in the same way that reality television and home video kind of created the found footage genre now that we had a language for it. But let me ask you this. Is the person who dials up the machine to target a certain memory, are they culpable for what comes through it?
I mean, I would say they're equally as culpable. Like you, I assume, man, especially pre-Google, internet searches were really tricky. And sometimes you would run across horrific shit you didn't mean to see, right? The question is do you keep watching, right? That's where the ethical place is.
Well, but no, because Google, you know, and this is what happened with YouTube. YouTube, as it was burgeoning and exploding in popularity on the back of copyrighted content, YouTube skated by way of, well, we're safe harbor. Like, we don't watch what comes in, you know, so if you want to report what's getting uploaded, we'll take action past there. But, like, you can't just sue us for some rando uploading something. So I would feel like you would kind of have to have the same thing if you're operating this machine where it's just like, hey, listen, we'll target memories for you 18 and under, right? But it is up to you to decide which memories they are and whether or not they are illegal.
Well, and think about this, because in many ways, the artificial memories scenario is something that's already happening. We download artificial memories of murdering people all the time. And it's called Grand Theft Auto, where it's like you get this.
The artificial thing is like that's a degree of what we have. I'm like, I'm getting like if it's a thing that happened and you just pressing a button to trigger this thing that's.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't see how it does good because people have hijacked planes. People have run over people in the streets. Like, I mean, the fact that the simulation I'm playing is not exactly that guy doesn't necessarily change. I mean, does it or does it? Does it's like, no, this is made of that actual.
Well, because. We are assuming, and that's why I think we do kind of have to – there are two sort of different conversations.
Yeah.
You know, because once we get into, you know, the – now it becomes art if it's fake. Like if it is – and not to say that it's not art that these things happened and it is real, but like there is something that you just can't get around – if it's somebody else that doesn't consent to having this true first person account of something that they did in graphic, visual, and audio detail.
I mean, I think it is art either way, because we could certainly say like the GTA simulation is art, but also it's definitely art that there exists this performance artist named Stonehenge who gives performance art pieces in which everybody gathers around and watches him amputate bits of his fingers at a time. He's kept on doing it till he's down to stumps, basically. I mean, that's art, but also, should it be legal? Or what is the ethical...
He's doing that to himself.
Yeah.
What I think when we get into the questionable, you know, sexual memories realm, these are other people. People who likely still exist. And now, here's another element of that. Is it different if the other person in that sexual memory is still with us? Like, if they can have their reputation impugned by broadcasting a personal memory of them, and let's even say that this is beyond the kiddie porn element of it, but this is like something that that hot crazy girlfriend of mine in 2003 is now a staffer for a state senator and is contemplating office for herself. Is it different if she is there living?
To be honest, it feels
3 years later, and now it's like, yeah, it might be gross of me to do it, but at least it's not ruining somebody else's life.
Well, we're kind of seeing some of that happen now, because what I think will happen is as the technology emerges, there'll be a sea change in expectations. For example, 10 years ago, leaked photos of you know, a senator drunk at a party or whatever would be scandalous and a big deal. And nowadays we live in a sort of warts and all society where everyone expects that there's going to be, you know, someone doing a line of cocaine photo here and there showing up.
At a Revision 3 party.
Yes. Whilst talking about how much he loves his effing wife, Bonnie.
I think one thing will happen, what's going to happen there too, is it's becoming so much easier to manufacture fakes that you're going to get to a point where you won't know if it's real or not. And it'll be like, maybe, maybe not. But I've already seen all the photos I can imagine, you know, of my favorite actress doing things because somebody, or videos even, you know, the ability to replace heads and stuff. So let's change topic now if we can.
Okay.
So imagine if you will, you're a personality who has a YouTube channel,
mm-hmm.
right on the verge of passing a million subscribers.
All quite right. A milestone, yeah.
That's an amazing milestone.
Big time. You know what? I'm checking right now, and it looks as though fewer than 1,000 channels have ever crossed that milestone. It looks like, as of right now, only 974 channels in the history of the world have ever crossed that milestone.
Brian, who would be a new channel to be able to cross that very soon?
Looks like So Close to Toast just did, and Made You Look is about to. And oh, wait, there's somebody behind there. I didn't know it was only two under. I'm third in line. Like, I've sat there with my ticket. Scam School is third in line to cross over. That's crazy.
So Brian is only 3,500 away from having a million subscribers. If you go to YouTube.com/scam school. Subscribe. We can put them over the top faster than possible. Brian is the point to pass a million subscribers. A million subscribers. You know how much that is?
That's a platinum selling record. Gold records, and not that I'm obsessively checking all these stats. A gold record sells 500,000 copies. A platinum selling record sells a million. This is the rough equivalent of that.
By the way, you're ahead of Jason Mraz, which I am positive my fake crazy ex-girlfriend from that last scenario would be a huge fan of.
Yeah. Wait in line, Jason Mraz. You can cross after me, all right?
So you're passing... You're already way past like MSNBC viewership numbers.
Oh, wow.
That's an amazing achievement. So, sir, bravo.
Thank you. That's very kind. I wasn't fishing for a compliment, by the way. It's just something I've been watching on the periphery, and it's like all of a sudden like, oh, my God, it's happening.
Well, yep, Brian.
Very valuable definition of periphery, Brian. By periphery, you mean sitting with two eyes focused on the computer and having all of your meals delivered to you as you steadily watch the count grow up. Yeah, no, periphery.
So, Brian, brings me to a new topic.
Uh-oh.
You said watching. You ever wonder who's watching?
Man, it's I can look at the demographics. It's mostly boys. I can tell you that much. It's like 90% male we skew.
Well, there's a very interesting research paper that just came out, and it talks about another audience that could be watching these channels, and particularly stuff that you do. Robots, Brian.
Oh, doggone it. This is you're killing my party. No, I don't mean like little click robots.
I mean, there are some researchers, University of Maryland and the Australian Research Center, NICTA, have published a paper on their achievement. And what they did is they have actual mechanical robots plugged into a system that watches YouTube cooking channels. And the robot is able to watch where the hands go and what the hands do and then replicate that. They've had this watch, you know, dozens of YouTube videos, and it's able to learn by watching the video to do these things.
Holy cow. I read a similar thing saying that they could similar robots could watch a cat video and have like a 60% chance of correctly identifying what was and wasn't a cat.
And we've gone to this point where it's not just recognition. It's the idea of, which is still less than your two-year-old, you know. Your child, youngest?
Yeah. She just turned two last month. Yeah.
All right, good. I got that right.
Well done.
Almost. So, you know, she's still better than, you know, the most powerful computer in the world is only 66% accurate. She's probably 100 identifying cats. But anyhow, but now you have robots that are able to watch people do things. So you can have a robot watching Scam School, give it a deck of cards, and then write angry letters saying that you're exposing magic. You are ruining magic.
When I was but a calculator.
I earn it and think.
I'll tell you what this reminds me of is aren't there sports writer robots, Justin, that look at the incoming stats? Like they see the raw numbers come in and they sort of, you know, up on the fly, write up a blog post about what's happening to automatically update?
I don't know.
Oh, have you not heard of this? I mean,
there's the QuakeBot for LA Times, which writes earthquake reports.
Oh, wow.
I know that it would probably be indistinguishable from most game cap sports writing.
Yeah, look at this. Big swing, robot sports writer outperforms human is an NPR story. That's amazing. So they got one that that more people like the writing of the robot than the human being.
There's and let's be honest, that's what many blogs really do, is they just repurpose what other people are saying anyway. So.
Oh, sure. Echo chamber.
Yeah, so like LA Times uses what's called QuakeBot. And so what it does is as soon as there's an earthquake, it publishes it and it says there was another recent earthquake, blah, 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 blah. So it's automated warning, you know, it's fascinating and it's kind of, it's a very interesting area, but you have robots watching and doing stuff. And, you know, Brian, is the next version of Scam School just going to be a robot that's inventing magic tricks?
Probably. They can read manuscripts from 1906 and try to figure out how to repurpose it with beer coasters and a piece of string. Then you tell me what you got then, robot. I totally believe it. You know, this is, we talked before about that wonderful Wired article where it talked about the cycle of acceptance, where it's like, you know, first deny that a robot can do your job, then admit it can help, but there's things it can't do, then admit it can also do those things, then admit that you're glad that it's doing all the parts you didn't like, and now you get to focus on running the robot, and then get ready for the robot to replace your new job. I'm okay with that, man. It's like all that does is create abundance and allow us to do more of the like, I think I'm at the point now where I have a thought, like just then when you were like talking about QuakeBot, I'm like, let me look it up. And my hands went to the keyboard and I was so mad because in that moment I knew what I wanted. I wanted QuakeBot to be up there. And I was like, oh, but I got to type all these letters and then hit enter and then wait the 4 milliseconds for it to come up or whatever. Like we think so fast. Even when we stumble on a name, I want a robot so fast that it instantly whispers into my mind the name that I'm trying to access at that moment. Like I was listening to Penn Sunday School and they were trying to access the name of Alex Jones and it was like 20 seconds of dead stammering air and I was like, it's Alex Jones is who you're trying to conjure. And then they finally did and I was like, I'm just ready for robots to correct all of our stupid flaws and make all of us awesome.
I would love a Google Watch that listens into conversations and when names come up it pops up like Wikipedia entries and stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
just a constant feed, or just something that you could like just pull up that live feed of it.
It'd be his words come up or whatever. Like last night I was talking to somebody and we're trying to remember James McAvoy's name.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, you know, play Professor X. We're like, oh, Patrick Stewart. Like, no, the new Professor X, you know, and then, you know, was in the Dune. Like, and then it's remembered, you know, James McAvoy. But it's like it could be like those sort of triggers. I mean, that's
wrap your mind around this is, you know, there's always that gap, because what will happen is you'll be thrilled once that comes out in the next 10 years. And you're so thrilled that you've cut, you know, your stammering accessing time in half. But then you'll be mad, like, oh, I know the answer's on my wrist, but I got to look all the way down and I have to read and take myself out of the moment. Why can't it just project that or take over my mouth for a second to say that name?
Or just appear in my head. At some point it will, you know, at some point. And that's going to be one of the first leaps to when we decide to integrate our consciousness with a digital version, is the idea that it's not just we upload, it's sideloading. Is that more and more of what we do is we offset or offload some of the processes that way.
By the way,
also, like, once it becomes more signal than noise, right? Or even like we culturally are able to or come up with parsing what that information is. Like now, like I can in my head right now contextualize when I would want to look down at just something that listened to my conversations and brought up Wikipedia entries on everything. Like I feel like I would know soft spots where I'd be like, oh, okay, yeah. But like with like Google Glass, one of the biggest problems I had with that user interface is that it was really great at bringing me information. It was not great at learning what was the best information. And it was hard to edit the stuff that I really wanted, because very often I don't know. It is things in that – there are things in that context that I would find I would like if it were smarter and more adaptable as a more robust user experience.
Man, I feel like these are just early days conversations. This is the equivalent of us griping in the early 1990s about our 56K dial-up modems. And wouldn't it be great if somehow we could access things, whatever. And here we are, you know, only 20 years later. And, you know, we got gigabit connections to the internet. And they're super fast. Like, I think that's about the same size of gap between what we're able to do with searches on the fly. I think, you know, 20 years from now, we'll definitely have that. It'll fully contextualize. It'll be listening to what you say, and it will serve it up to you immediately. And then we'll be griping about how it's not in our brains instantly.
We're always going to have something to gripe about. But it's that – and a big, you know, the magic word singularity here, folks, is we have this idea of what we think it'll look like, but there's this point at which – we have no idea what it'll look like, you know,
and can't know, right? Like by definition, once we get to that, once the ideas start getting generated by the machines, you know, we can't project that far, because they'll come up with innovative, efficient solutions that, you know, by definition, we can't figure out with our crude primate brains.
Gentlemen, speaking of crude primate brains.
Yep.
Is it time for picks?
Well, first off, let's go ahead and remind everybody that patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support the show. We have officially hired last week on air our new producer, Bryce Castillo, Neshcom. He is going to be coming on and taking on a lot of the work that really is going to make this show all the better, including finding new ways that we can make this place better. So, head on over, and if you want to support the show, then go to patreon.com/weirdthings, and we will be continuing to evolve and bring this show to yet more levels of awesomeness.
By the way, we continue to see all of those patrons start trickle in. We can't thank you guys enough. I get all the email alerts whenever a new person joins, so I love looking down and seeing that they're joining the Weird Things team. We're creeping up on 400 patrons, doing almost two-thirds of a way to our goal of $1,000 an episode, enough to get a little bit of scratch for the three of us and cover a producer and special projects as well.
Gentlemen.
Yeah.
Is it time for us to do picks?
Yep.
I will go first. This is a book that I've only perused, but I've read some of the stuff online, and it's selling crazy, crazy, crazy well. It does not need our help, but I'm happy to help it out anyways. Randall Munroe's What If, right? He's the creator of the XKCD comic, and he also loves to explain things. And he's got these wonderful explanations, like, you know, people would ask him random questions. You know, if my printer could literally print out money, would it have a big effect on the world? And he goes into breakdown. How much money could your printer print? What would be the economic impact of that? Things like he's, I don't know if it's in here, but like what would happen if, you know, I put a, you know, ball of water the size of the earth into the sun? You know, would it put it out? And so a lot of crazy, weird questions. And, you know, it's just a fun way to see how he breaks some stuff down. I think he's a wonderful, wonderful teacher, wonderful ability to explain things.
Yeah.
How high can a human throw things? And so this book I highly recommend, called What If. It's just fun to pick it up and just look at sort of random stuff. You know, the cover of it is a Tyrannosaurus being thrown into a Sarlacc pit. So, you know, he's one of our people.
You had me at Tyrannosaurus in a Sarlacc pit. is this all just words? Is there an audiobook version or is there pictures?
There is an audiobook version, but and it seems to have good reviews, but he does things that are so visual.
Yeah. So he includes a bunch of like XKCD. How that feels, though. He includes a bunch of XKCD style comics in there, I assume.
Yeah. Yeah. Plenty of that. So anyhow, that is my pick. I love people explaining things.
I don't have a very original pick, but it's something that, I'm really excited to share with my kids that and I'm surprised that in some ways they're too young for it, because there's moments I cringe, and in other ways it's just right because the pacing of it is a little bit slower than most other things that you would see if it were to come out today. But I introduced my kids. We watched the pilot for Futurama. Futurama's on Netflix, and it just popped up randomly, and I clicked it for Josie, who's 7 years old. And, you know, Josie is the less affected by violent imagery, and, you know, she's a little more stoic on her content. She really enjoyed watching the PG-13 Godzilla. Penelope, however, is highly attracted to the comedy, and the fact that they set up running gags and that there's a sort of a more leisurely pace as each little self-contained. They don't mind having the whole joke being, yeah, we're still going on this. And between the two, they're really enjoying it. You know, Penny's 10, Josie's 7, so the only thing I have to bristle at is when they keep, you know, they fall in love with using the word ass, or, you know, and there's a few awkward conversations, you know, when they you know, make a gay joke or whatever, and the kids just, you know, aren't old enough that they have any interest in that world. And so, you know, when it comes to that moment, I'll be happy to have the conversation with them, but it's always like, oh, are they gonna ask? Nope, they don't really care. All right, get it. And at any rate, it's really awesome to go back and realize how deeply that first season affected me 15 years ago, man, 16 years ago. Like, I still knew the setup, that you hear the setup for the gag and you know the payoff, where it's like you start singing the full Wailers on the Moon song. I don't know. It's great. Anyway, it's really enjoying that trip down memory lane.
I still remember viscerally when that show first debuted, and the idea of, you know, the concept of like the Simpsons kind of hitting its creative peak and yet continuing to go was sort of in the culture at that point. And this was like, what if we got to restart the Simpsons? Like, that was this idea that, which is like a really creatively unfair mantle to put on any kind of new show, to just be like, hey, be like the most creatively lauded, successful cartoon of all time, and go. Although, you know, it really did succeed. I'd be really curious to rewatch that first season because it's been so long since I've seen it.
Yeah, it holds up, man. Holds up. The pacing is, you know, it's a little bit older fashioned, which is a weird thing to say about something that had a long and storied, 12-year run. And it's also awesome to, so often, when it comes to cartoons, you see massive swings in the various voices. But of course, because they're all Billy West, you feel very, just ever being like, well, that's a little different than I remember Zoidberg sounding in most of the series. You can tell he's kind of finding his footing on that
voice. Yeah. Awesome. Well, listen, Brian, unlike you, I'm going to have two extraordinarily, groundbreakingly original picks, the likes of which no one has ever heard of.
Super excited.
First, I randomly found, with no assistance, Alex Winter's documentary Downloaded about Napster, which in all truth, Andrew told me to watch, and was amazing. If you haven't seen it, that is Alex Winter as, you know, from Bill and Ted's fame, but it
Wait,
is
really. I have no idea.
Yeah,
director of The Dark Backward as well.
What was that?
Director of The Dark Backward.
Yes.
Wait, is this? It looks as though it's totally free right now on AOL. Is that right?
On Netflix too.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right. Right on. That's awesome.
I saw it on. Yeah. I saw it on Netflix. If it's free, then that's rad. You should watch it no matter how you can get it, as long as it's legally available. Although those are the questions that are really at the heart of the documentary. And it's I think it does about as I would have liked to have seen, only because I'm less familiar with their side of the story. The documentary does a good, a serviceable enough job of getting inside the RIAA and the label heads at the point of impact when Napster really hit and became became big. And they, Hillary Rosen describes of the RIAA describes this meeting of all the heads of the record companies who hated each other for various
other because they've spent the last forever competing with each other and cutthroating and
That she has Napster open on a computer and just has each of them name a song, and she just types in the song and boom, it's there. And it was informative in seeing where, you know, how they looked at that problem, and they're looking at this as if it's a warehouse somewhere where they have all these songs and they are bootlegging and distributing it, because that was how they solved privacy issues in the past. You know, that was what the piracy fight for the RIAA and the labels had been up till then. And if we are going to give a mulligan for, you know, the Napster guys being maybe a little willfully ignorant in terms of you know, what they were and how they wanted to fight their battles. And they certainly, inside of Napster, they very much second-guessed their own strategy on how they went about explaining what they did. Then I almost feel like we need to at least, not to sympathize with the RIAA and the label companies, but like at least understand where their positions were and how much we can all understand it was just a flashpoint of, you know, for all of culture and where digital culture and where what we had understood it to be kind of collided. So it was good. It was very well done, and I encourage everybody to watch it.
Man, I'll definitely have to watch that. Is it all sympathetic to the RIAA, or is it just
no? This is a very small part of it, but it's just like, really, I mean, I've grown up, you know, using Napster and reading about Napster and understanding, you know, a little bit more about the Napster side. It's not like the RIAA has run out or people have been really excited to hear, you know, the Death Star opinion about why the Galactic Empire needed to be regulated.
Yeah, I mean, it's much more, you know, the point of view of Sean Fanning and Parker about that, but trying to kind of go into and sort of show that other side. I mean, I think that my criticism was that there was some Napster shenanigans that were not covered that would have kind of made their, hey, we didn't know, kind of case even less. But I thought it was I enjoyed it thoroughly, though.
Right on. If there's time to squeeze in one more pick, I want to give a special thanks to Patrick Delahanty and the throng of others who suggested that we pick up the Lego Marvel Super Heroes on the PlayStation 4. It's so great, and it's so awesome just to see, like, especially for my kids. You know, Penny has I got her a subscription to Marvel Digital Unlimited, and so she's familiar with, you know, a few branches of the Marvel tree, but to have her sort of understand, you know, why Doctor Strange is rad or what, you know, they keep calling him Rock Guy. And I'm like, his name's The Thing. Why are you not reading Fantastic Four? You know, it's, I don't know. It was really a delightful time, and it's a well-crafted game.
Cool.
And I would like to, again, extend my super original pick streak by recommending this book by Andy Weir, The Martian.
Oh, are you in? How far in are you?
I got like 3 hours left.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Okay. So what is the hook that keeps drawing you in? Cause I've tried to figure out what the alchemy is that makes that such a rad book. And I've listened to it twice now.
You know, I think it's funny that Andrew recommended What If and Randall Monroe's entertaining way of explaining complex problems that, you know, for me, The Martian is, it's like in the way that, like, if you watch The Wire, you're not really knowing, you're not really understanding what the plight of the Baltimore, you know, streets are, right? But you kind of feel like you know more about the plight of the Baltimore streets. And The Martian is kind of this I feel like I know more about NASA and the spirit of ingenuity and never say die. And it is kind of this, at least up till the point that I'm reading it, and I assume it will finish this way, this kind of love letter to the good and the ill of not only the space program, but NASA itself and the astronauts who populate it. It's good. It's really good. It's extremely well written, and I'll probably talk more about it when I finish it.
Yeah, I suspect a big part of it is just the bright sunshine of our protagonist's optimism. You know, even when things go bad, like by all rights, he should feel utterly defeated and broken at so many points of the book, and he just doesn't. And it's just, I love it. I aspire to be as good a person and as positive a vibe as he is.
As Mark Watney.
Mark Watney, yeah. There you go. Thanks. I didn't want to access it. Google wasn't listening on the watch and couldn't, you know.
Mark Watney.
Yeah, exactly.
Gentlemen, on an upcoming episode of Weird Things.
This is so huge.
We're going to reveal what happened right here when I sat in this chair.
What?
Emitting a fluid.
Wait, we have to wait till a future episode?
Wait, what?
We're going to spend a week thinking you were peeing during the show?
I spit into a vial for a 23andMe DNA analysis.
Yeah, because they shut down 23andMe in the U.S., but I guess it's open in England
shut it
now?
Down. They just can't give you a report as far as disease.
Okay, but you can't, because I noticed now all the ads talk about, you know, that's 23andMe.co.uk, because if you live in the UK, you can find out all this stuff.
Yeah, but you can still do it here, and they'll do their ancestry. They won't tell you your genetic, like what your disease is, what might kill you, because so, you know, we can be protected by ignorance, I guess. You can find out your ancestry. So I'm curious to find out. So I figured I'd do that. I'd recommend you guys do the same thing. We could all do these revelations of what are we.
Well, I already got mine, bro. I did mine for Ancestry.com for the Jury Moore podcast. Ashley and I both did it, which Ancestry.com, it's a very similar process, but they kind of their pitch is that already so many people have done it through them and have traced their lineage that you find other distant genetic cousins that have also used the same service, or at least what they would assume based on.
So this kind of becomes like a Facebook thing where the more people participate, the more valuable the search becomes, right?
Yeah. Although I assume it's probably, I mean, the Andrews report will be fairly similar to what I got, which is a bunch of percentages on where my parentage was. And maybe I should save my results. You can hear it on the Jury Moore podcast, but I'll save. There was a huge surprise for my genetic lineage that I had no idea about and was apparently fairly dominant.
Oh, man. All right. Now I am going to have to dive in on this. All right. I'll go ahead and sign up for it. Although I do want to know all my diseases. I want to know what I'm going to die of.
There's ways to take that data and then go to, like, sites that will correlate and tell you that. Huh. So, gentlemen, it's been weird. Mm-hmm.